Welcome, everyone, to episode 37 of The Science Files with Dr. Rob. Today is a special day in Halifax. Yes, it's Municipal Elections Day, and if you haven't got out and voted, please do. As our co-host today, we're delighted to welcome back Associate Dean of Science and Science Champion, Dr. Adam Sardi. Behind the glass, as always, is our amazing producer, Leah Batstone, who'll be answering your calls. Next week, if you've been waiting on tenderhooks, Richard Zarowski will be back. But we're going to keep him in the co-host chair first because he's not so good with the buttons. And we'll have a very, very special guest. 2015 Nobel Prize winner and Sydney boy, Dr. Art MacDonald, will join us to talk about the science of neutrinos and to tell us how much of a whirlwind it's been for him over the past year. And in case you didn't know, Art was just appointed to the Order of Nova Scotia. So well done, Art. But let's focus on today, because we're going to dive into some marine mammal biology with Dr. Tim Fraser. So get ready to have a whale of a time, and today's theme is no fluke. Okay, I'll stop with the puns. More seriously, have you ever wondered how we can follow and identify species that live in the depths of the oceans? What if we can't put radio transmitters on them? What other choices do we have? And for that matter, how can we keep track of their overall populations? Not such a big deal, you think? Well, think again. Humans have killed an estimated 1 million whales in 200 years, and some groups have placed a quarter of whales, dolphins, and porpoises on the endangered species list. Following whales can be exhausting, smelly, and even sometimes pretty dirty work. Just how dirty? Well, given how much whales eat, have you ever wondered what whale poop is like? Tim and his research collaborators have even sampled that. That sounds like messy business. And if you know what you can use it for, you can use it for some pretty practical science. You can even approximately track whales based upon poop DNA, or DNA from poop, and identify individuals that you didn't know were there before. Pretty interesting stuff. And although I focused on marine mammals in this introduction, actually Tim's research is focused on animal conservation through the use of genetics. DNA analysis and genetics are in general becoming a bit of a Swiss Army knife for understanding populations. We can even ask how genetics shape patterns of mate choice, individual health, and relative success of reproductivity. From whales through to bats, the research that goes on in his lab is helping to understand the issues that put species at risk and what steps can be taken to help. But before we learn about things genetic, let's review what's been a pretty fun week in science. And to help us with that, we're going to welcome back Adam Sardi, and I'll guess we'll let him open his blowhole.
Yeah, I don't know if I like that one there, Rob. But thanks for having me on again. And
thanks for
talking about biodiversity and people killing things.
Yeah, it's awkward for us as physicists.
I know, but there was this Outside Magazine article this week where there was an opinion article written, maybe with tongue-in-cheek, saying that the Great Barrier Reef is now dead, and there was an obituary from, 25 million B.C. to 2016, goodbye Great Barrier Reef. Is this true, Rob?
So you can understand why they wrote it. So there have been a number of reports in the media about significant coral bleaching. So coral bleaching happens when basically the corals end up expelling algae and they basically die. And so in this particular case, what they're seeing is basically the whole reef now has some level of bleaching to a certain extent or another. And this was what really drove the obituary. But the reality is that the reef is not all dead. There are bits of it that can recover from this. There are bits of it that may have really significant problems. But this is, it's a little bit depressing to read this, because would it make you give up hope?
Yeah, when I read it, not being a biologist, and it seemed pretty clear that, I guess it's dead and we're in trouble. No, I don't understand all of it. If the coral's bleached, is it dead?
That particular coral itself can be dead, yes, but it may not be in a state that it can't recover. So most of the time, and I'm sure our guest will be able to correct us on this once we get to the second part of the show, but at the end of the day, there is the possibility that if you have mild bleaching, you can recover from that. It doesn't mean that's the end of it. It's a question of what the level of bleaching is, and then that determines whether or not this whole system is going to die or whether it can recover or not. But I think the big thing for me is reading this is we're not at a point where we should give up.
No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, we have to imagine that the coral reef has been through some ups and downs in its 25 million year history, and are we really seeing the end? This is one opinion, and I guess I'd like to see a bit more science.
Yeah, so there is a lot of science going on, but I think the one thing that makes this really, really difficult is the fact that the whole system is basically providing a lot of jobs for people. There's a lot of tourism around the Great Barrier Reef, and as such, an article like this might tend to make people say, well, I'm not going to go to the Great Barrier Reef anymore.
Yeah, and hopefully we don't do science based on what the tourism industry is telling us
to
say.
I would very much agree with you. But it's a difficult issue, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot more studies done, and I hope there are things that we can do, because all of this is wrapped up into climate change as well. Bleaching happens partially as a product of changing water and increasing temperatures as well.
Right, and related to that, I saw another article this week about water and microbes in water.
Oh, yeah, I love this one.
And this seemed a bit more positive. And this again, as a physicist talking biology, but it seemed that when a researcher was trying to understand, you know, how difficult it was for him to get the microbes he wanted that could withstand these extreme conditions, high pH, saltiness, that he wanted to test in, he started to wonder whether he could find it more locally. And in fact, he went to his local pond in his forest and really tried to extract. And in his amplifying bioreactor, put some extreme conditions.
Okay. So let's.
He found amazing microbes.
Let's actually talk about what an amplifying bioreactor is. So, in this particular case, this is fun because this is a little bit of accidental science in some ways as well. So the amplifying bioreactor is actually, all they had was a flask and they were putting water in one end and basically letting it go in, things evolve and so on, and then taking the water out. So they were flushing it through and they
just
were seeing
flow through and then put some big conditions, extreme conditions on the inside.
So originally they were just looking at how things survived on the basis of the flow rate, like how quickly do they reproduce, can they survive in different rates going through and taking them away and so on. But then they said, well, let's change the environment. Let's make it more acidic, let's make it more basic or caustic, or let's make it more saline. And amazingly, they just carried on turning it up, and they got some things that would survive in like the equivalent of household bleach, just in your pond.
Or stomach acid,
yeah. It's really amazing. I mean, so what are the applications of this? Well, I mean, I don't know, if you find like yeasts that can survive really, really high sugar, you can change the kind of fermentations you do and so on. There are tons of applications for these things. So this is really incredible, I think.
So I think with that kind of amazing biodiversity that we keep discovering, I wonder, maybe we need not be so negative as that obituary. But hey, we could get back to something that you know a little bit more about.
Are you going to go with the galaxies thing?
There was some astrophysics thing this week, wasn't there, Rob?
Yeah, sure. So this was actually getting a lot of press. And so some places, some outlets said that, you know, suddenly the universe has 10 times more galaxies than we previously thought. And so when I saw this, I was like, well, you know, I think we actually have a pretty good handle on this. So I went and read it. And it's one of those cases where, in fact, you know, it's all about definitions. And sorry, we didn't sort of suddenly lose, what was it, about 2 trillion galaxies?
So they say now there's 2 trillion galaxies, more than 10 times as we previously thought.
So what we used to say was, roughly speaking, if you look at the size of our own galaxy, there's probably about 200 billion of these throughout the rest of the observable universe. And so what these people have said is, well, you know, actually the observable universe, as we look out, we go back in time. So we should be looking at what happens to the universe at earlier and earlier epochs. And it turns out the way galaxies form, you get very, very small galaxies that come together and merge together to form bigger and bigger in galaxies. So if you go back in time, you had a lot more galaxies. And so they basically said this, we kind of knew this. The problem is we can't see these tiny little galaxies right now. We don't have telescopes that are big enough to see them. And so at the very end of the article, and I think this was kind of why it was written, they say, if we really want to see all the galaxies in the observable universe, we need much bigger telescopes.
Yeah, so this was done using the Hubble Space Telescope over very long exposures, is that?
That's right. And so the problem there remains that the Hubble Telescope is a very small telescope. It's only 2.5 meters in diameter. And you compare that to some of the things we're talking about building now. There we're talking about building telescopes that are 30 meters in diameter. So that's a really
huge improvement.
You're talking about 10 times bigger in diameter and 100 times bigger in area. So that's a big, big difference.
And the initial number that we talked about where the 2 trillion is 10 times higher, that initial number was from the 90s. And there they say that the Hubble was probing back to 12 billion light years away.
Yeah. And so they've gone back to 13 billion now, basically, a little bit over 13 billion.
Okay. So how old is the universe?
13.7. So we're literally going back to only 700 million years, which is still a long time compared to human lifespans, obviously. But in the big scheme of the lifetime of the universe, that's a very small period of time.
But I'd say when, like you were saying, when you're that close to the Big Bang, what you call a galaxy, how you define a galaxy must be much different than what we see today.
Exactly. They're literally 1,000 times smaller, right? So they're really, really small galaxies compared to what we see now. So one other thing that I loved, people with autism make more logical decisions.
This was an interesting one because this talks about how people make decisions either rationally or based on emotions. And so
you a gut feeling person?
Yeah, and there was this study that was even out earlier this year from University of Southern California about the gut, like following somatic markers, chemicals released from your gut. And if you paid attention to those, then you made more snap decisions based on whether that was making you anxious or not. So there's a lot of research around what's driving people's decisions. And so this newest one was looking at how people with autism who have a different relationship with their emotions than people without autism and how they made decisions.
So this is actually, I think this is really interesting in terms of how we present information to people now, because we've realized that as a society, we are actually driven by emotions when we make decision making. So now a lot of things are framed in an emotional way. And I actually find this quite challenging. I mean, this research is showing that really is an issue. Like, you are influenced by your emotions when you make decisions. And so when psychologists know this and then marketers use this, we're being bombarded by all of this research constantly. And it's no wonder we have a growing mental health issues, at least in my opinion. I'd love to know what the research says on that, quite frankly.
Yeah, and it also talks about how trying to get people to make decisions based on their emotions and getting the emotions to override rational thought is probably driving a lot of what we might see in election campaigns around this time of year.
There we go. Okay, so that's the summary for this week. You're listening to The Science Files. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to The Science Files. Today, we're going to take a deep dive into some marine mammal biology. And I'm really, really pleased to welcome our guest this week, St. Mary's Professor, Dr. Tim Fraser. Tim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And as is the tradition on the show, one of the things we love to ask and find out is how you actually got a start in what you do, what made you interested, and so on. So how did you get started in marine biology, I guess?
Yeah, it's actually a long story. I'll try to keep it short. So it's interesting. I'm actually from Colorado, and so a very landlocked place. And to be honest, I don't know what triggered my interest in whales. Just as long as I can remember,
What were your mom and dad doing?
My dad is an actuary, so he did a lot of math.
Okay.
And my mom's a potter, so she does artwork. And I think kind of like most kids, you go through a stage where you're interested in dinosaurs, and a lot of kids go through a stage when they're interested in whales. And I just never grew out of it. And kind of the more I learned about them, the more interested I became in them. And it's actually really interesting because when I first went to university, you know, you're assigned someone to help you figure out what classes you can take.
And
he said, you know, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to study whales. And he actually laughed and was like, yeah, what do you really want to do? You know, he's like,
did you go to university? This is a lesson here.
Yeah, well, that's another story. So I knew I wanted to study whales. So I toured a lot of different universities, and I went to one that had a great marine biology program.
Okay.
And then I got there, and it was called Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. And
Washington State, right?
Yeah. It's a beautiful place. And it turned out their marine biology program was really like tide pool ecology and invertebrate zoology, and just wasn't my cup of tea at all. And so I talked to a few professors and said, you know, if I want to study whales, what should I be doing? Because clearly majoring in marine biology wasn't really going to do it. And they said, just get a degree in biology from anywhere, and then what you do in graduate school is really what's going to, really what you're going to focus on something. And so I actually, girlfriend at the time was at the University of North Dakota because they have a good aviation program, and she was a pilot. And so I transferred.
I was going to say, that's pretty far from the ocean as well.
Yeah, so I transferred to North Dakota, which It's very cold, very flat, the opposite of Bellingham, Washington. And so I got my degree from there.
Good skiing at University of North Dakota.
There's no, maybe cross country skiing. Yeah. And so, so I did my undergraduate degree there, and it actually turned out really good because it's a pretty small school, and I got to interact one-on-one with my professors and work with them there, and I got a lot of experience. And then when I went to graduate school, it was the first time I actually got to work with whales.
So themselves. Where did you go to grad school? I'm curious.
McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario.
Ah, okay. So, Canadian connection there.
Yeah, so I moved to Canada. I moved to Canada specifically to work with a particular person at McMaster University who was studying the species of whales that I was interested in.
Okay, very cool. So can you tell us a bit about how you do your work? I mean, I understand you have a lab, but you're also actively, I'm going to say the field, you're not really on the field, you're on the ocean and so on. But how do you balance the two and how do they kind of fit together?
Yeah, so it's really changed over time. I think when I was just getting started, you know, I pictured my life being on a boat surrounded by whales. And
You mean it isn't?
No, and actually, you know, as an undergrad, I didn't like genetics at all. And I tried to avoid taking genetics and things like that. My graduate work was on the North Atlantic right whale, which I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with. They're an endangered species. And
So how many individuals are we talking about being left in the right whales?
They've been slowly increasing. So when I started, we said there were about 300 of them left, and now they're up to about 500.
Okay.
So the more I was on the boat and the more I was around the whales and thinking about the problems they were facing, it turned out one of the problems that they have is they have a low reproductive rate. It's much lower than what we know they're capable of. So with whales, at least with North Atlantic right whales, we can identify individuals based on natural markings that occur on their bodies. And so it's easy to tell who the mom of a calf is because the mom will lactate for about a year, and so the calf's nursing for a year. So we can tell who the mom of the calves are. But to me, to really understand the reproductive problem, we needed to know who the dads were. And the only way to do that is with genetics. So it works the same way as, you know, I'm sure people have heard of, you know, every once in a while, like Justin Bieber has to have a paternity case, you know, something where they get a genetic sample from him and from the putative offspring and the
You've just created mother. A link between whales and Justin Bieber. Yeah. I mean, I don't think we've had that on the show before.
Yeah, so it's the same idea. If we have a genetic profile from mom and a genetic profile from a calf, and then we have genetic data from a whole pool of males, then we can assign fathers to each calf. And so that was essentially my PhD, was doing paternity analyses for the whole species. And based on that, trying to figure out what this reproductive problem is and to try to ultimately try to fix what's going on there.
So I know you've done, another pun, now you've dived right into it. So, and that was completely not deliberate. I've got to ask you how you actually go about getting the DNA. I mean, is the DNA the same? Well, presumably the DNA is roughly the same in all cells in the body. But what do you go and sort of like sample from the whales and how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and I'll preface this by saying it sounds terrible, but it's all okay.
Because you have to do all sorts of like animal care protocols and things like that, don't you?
Yeah. So I'll give you a short answer, and then I'll kind of justify it all. So the short answer is we use a crossbow with a modified arrow on it. So if you hit the whale in their back or their peduncle, and then this arrow will bounce out and what's left in there is a small piece of skin about the size of a pencil eraser, like the old pencil eraser.
And so this is just a tip on the arrow that you have.
Yeah. So it's a normal crossbow, but the arrow's modified so that it has a stop collar, so that obviously we don't want the arrow to go through the whale. We want it just to go in a tiny bit and stop and then bounce out and float in the water. So it has a modified tip to collect this small skin sample. And so, of course, the people do this all over the world to collect samples from marine mammals, and we're there to help the whales. So certainly we don't want to do anything that's going to hurt them. And so before you can do a large-scale sampling effort on a particular species, you have to do a pilot study and collect a few samples, videotape it, and make sure that that the whales aren't having a response to this. And what we found is that
So you're saying you actually see whether the whales sort of like have a response to being sampled?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
For sure.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, but then you have to publish that. So you have to kind of publish a paper saying, "Here's how many samples we collected. Here's the response that the whales had. Based on that, we either think, 'Yep, it's okay to collect samples this way from this species, or no, it's not. And so what we found, and it makes sense, if you can think of how big a whale is, and we're taking a small piece of skin about the size of a pencil eraser, most of the species don't show any response at all when you do this. We think a lot of the times they don't even know that they've been hit, but obviously that effect gets larger as the size of the organism goes down.
That's completely fascinating. I've just got to jump right in because we've got to take a break for some messages, but we'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to the Science Files. On today's show, we're talking marine biology, marine mammals specifically, with Dr. Tim Fraser, who's having a whale of a time talking to us about all of these amazing things. Sorry, I can't help it with the puns. Anyway, so Tim, I want to come back to you, and I know that you actually get to really do your passion, but also to show that to younger people as well, running a marine mammal camp. Can you tell us what that exactly involves?
Yeah, so this is a camp that actually my wife and I, who's also a scientist, that we started 3 or 4 years ago, and it's an opportunity. It's about a 2-week camp for high school students to come, and they stay in the dorms at St. Mary's, and we teach them about marine mammals, about how we study them, and then we spend about 4 days on a boat with them as well, and so they get to see them and learn what it's like to study them.
So whereabouts does the boat go from? Is it from Halifax, or do you go up to Cape Breton? Or
No, we actually go from New Brunswick, so Campobello Island in New Brunswick.
Okay.
So we go over there just because we work closely with people over there for our research, and so we're kind of pulling from our pool of people who we already know to help make the camp work. But yeah, so the whole idea of it is that coming from Colorado, I didn't get to actually see my first whale until graduate school. And so I thought, naively, that...
You did better than I did. I didn't get to see my first whale until I was in my 40s. So.
Right, but it was my career path. I knew that was what I wanted to do. And so I came to Halifax, and I figured that there'd be lots of opportunities for people to get exposure to marine mammals and marine mammal biology a lot earlier than I did.
Yep.
And then I got here, and it turned out that that wasn't the case. And so my wife and I were talking about how great it would be if... or kind of how shocking it is that there's not that experience here, even though the whales are so close. And so we decided to make this summer camp.
So I've got to jump in. How many of the students who come along have actually been out on whale watching trips before they come on the marine mammal camps?
Not as many as you'd think. I'd say maybe about a third of them have seen whales before, but usually not to any great degree. Like maybe they went out once when they were a lot younger.
So what kind of feedback do you get? I mean, I've got to be honest and say that when we show like the night sky to people who haven't looked through a telescope before, that's always an awesome experience. So I'm imagining it must be pretty cool for some of these kids to see whales for the first time.
Yeah, no, it's always very exciting to see their first response. But one thing that's actually shocking to me is... I don't know if it's kids these days or just the different culture where they actually outwardly don't show it that much. Like they say they're excited and stuff, but we're always a little unsure about if the students are enjoying themselves during the course.
Because it's not cool to be sort of awed.
Well, that's
something.
I don't really understand. But then right after the course is over, we'll just be flooded with emails from the students, from their parents saying, you know, this was a life-changing experience and stuff. So it seems like the students really get a lot out of it and really enjoy it, but that's not something that we actually get from them during
the event.
Yeah,
okay.
We just hear about it
afterwards.
That's
really interesting.
Yeah.
So what is the age group again?
14 to 17.
Okay, so if you've been doing it for 4 years, have you got students who've gone on or you've tracked who've gone on to do like marine mammal degrees and so on?
Yeah, well, it's not yet. So all of our first year or kind of alumni... are just in university now. So yeah,
okay.
Yep, a lot of them keep in touch a lot of them are now pursuing science. I've seen some back at St. Mary's as undergraduate students now. So yeah.
Oh, this is very cool, very cool.
Yeah.
So I sort of teed up things in the introduction with a little story about poop.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to circle back to that, and you can tell us a bit about this. And I know because we were talking beforehand, there's a couple of funny stories on this, but tell us what about the story of looking at whale poop?
Yeah, sure. So it actually started because North Atlantic right whales have this reproductive problem, and there are a number of kind of signs that we are getting that females were losing calves. So females were pregnant at one time, but then they actually didn't give birth that year. And so we wanted to really nail down what was going on there. And so we thought, well, the best way to do that is like a pregnancy test, right? If we can get their hormone levels at the time when they think they're pregnant, then we could actually tell who's pregnant and who isn't. Of course, getting hormones from a whale is very difficult. And so the best way that actually my colleagues could think of was through the poop. And so we started that just...
Because you can't just go and sort of like, I don't know, sample blood or something like that. Presumably
right,
that's
exactly.
impossibly difficult.
Yeah. So we can't do it that way. And so the first, I think, 2 years, we just collect poop opportunistically. So if we're on the boat around the whales and they poop, then we'd pick it up. But our sample sizes were pretty small.
Sorry, I've just got this picture going, yay, it just pooped.
Yeah, that's what you hear. So most people would be really excited to see the whales. We see the whales and they poop and we're like, hey, there's poop over there. So getting excited about that.
Okay.
But so anyway, it turned out our success rate was pretty low. And so one member of the team was like, you know, there's poop-sniffing dogs. People use those all the time for terrestrial research. So for studying terrestrial mammals, why don't we train dogs to smell whale poop?
And Tim, it's underwater?
No, it floats. It floats right when they do it. Then it slowly sinks over time.
Yeah.
And so they trained two dogs to do it. And they said they learned, you know, dogs are much smarter than we give them credit for. They learned, like, instantly. And so, you know, the dogs have their life vests on. We take them out on the boat. And it turns out they can smell whale poop.
But you don't put the dogs in the water, though, do you?
Nope. It's just kind of how you'd picture it. So we have the dogs on the bow of the boat, and they're sniffing around.
I picture them swimming and trying to find the
dog. Yeah, no, they're just standing on the bow, and they'll sniff in all directions. Then when they get a scent, they point and they bark in that direction, and they lead us there.
It's like Lassie's found the whale poop.
Yeah.
What is it, Lassie? Right whale?
Yeah, and it works out great. So our sample size just went through the roof. I think a funny kind of side story to that is, so two dogs were trained for this, and it turns out one of them gets just violently seasick, and the other one is deathly afraid of whales. So the one that's scared of whales would smell the poop and get us there. So, but as soon as the whale got close, it would start whimpering and run to the bottom of the boat, and it would stay down there. But by then, we could see the whale and could see the poop. So,
so it didn't get used to the whales in any way. You couldn't train it to be used to the whales.
No. It was just funny that the two that we happened to train were not the best choices for the job.
So when you get the poop, do you know which whale it's from?
Right, so that's the big question. So that's how I got involved in it, really, is when it was just the humans finding the poop, we can't smell very well. So the whale was, by the time we smelled it, you know, the whale was still close by. But as soon as we started using the dogs, they could smell it from so far away that by the time we got there, the whale was long gone, and they didn't know who had left the sample. And of course, you need to know who it is for the hormone data to mean anything. So what we started doing was conducting genetic analyses of the poop to link it back to a specific whale. So we have a database of samples from almost everyone in the species. And so then we could compare the DNA profile that we got from each poop sample to our database and then link that poop sample to an individual. And that provided a way to link the hormone data to a particular individual.
I've got to jump in on that then. So did you ever have situations where you found poop and you couldn't link it to an individual? Like, could you use this to find new individuals?
Yeah, and that we actually did that a lot. And it's kind of a long story. So the North Atlantic right whale is an interesting one where, you know, people have been doing the field work on it for about 40 years. And really, kind of before we did the detailed genetic work, the idea was we really know this species. Like, the people doing the field work thought, okay, we know everyone, we know what they do. And then really one of the main things that came out of my PhD work with the paternity is it turned out that we didn't have samples for the fathers of most of the calves, which is weird because based on the field work, we had samples from about 80% of the males. But my paternity work said we're missing a huge chunk of males who are fathering these calves. So there must be more whales out there than we know about. And so we've always called them kind of these missing whales, and we're trying to pin down how many there are. But the poop analysis did suggested that as well, where there are a surprising number of poop samples where they didn't match anyone in our database. We could then infer that the population size is actually larger than what we think it is, but we haven't figured out really how to pin down how to estimate how many missing whales there are.
So you were mentioning this in the context of right whales, using it on other species at all, or just is it right whales?
For the fecal analysis, this sort of effort is really just with North Atlantic right whales now. Okay. But we're using similar ideas with lots of other species. So I'm working on the belugas in the St. Lawrence River. So they're endangered as well, a similar situation. And then also bowhead whales in the Arctic. We're using genetics to try to infer population sizes for those ones as well.
So aren't bowheads the whales that get really old?
Yeah, they live over 200 years. Yeah.
So I think I was reading something about they found one that had a 19th century harpoon in it or something like that.
Yeah, so this is the first kind of sign that they must live a lot older than what we kind of thought was. Yeah, so there's actually a native hunt in Alaska where this native group is allowed to kill a few bowheads every year, and there's scientists there that collect data from all the sample or collect samples and data from all the whales that are hunted. And one of them that they hunted was actually, it's kind of small. So the native bowheads get huge, but they only hunt the smaller ones because those are the ones that they can catch. And so this relatively small bowhead whale had a harpoon. When they cut it open, it had a harpoon in it that hadn't been used for 200 years. And of course, and the skin had healed over this harpoon. So that was the first kind of sign that maybe these things live a lot longer than we think. And then later someone came up with an aging technique where you can look at chemicals around the eye, and that's an accurate dating technique. And so from that we were able to confirm that, yeah, I think the oldest one that's been dated is about 220 years old. But again, these are from smaller individuals, so it's likely they actually live quite a bit longer than that.
So do we have any idea how old they have to be before they can reproduce at all?
It's about 30 to 35 years old. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So in your lab, do you have samples of poo and your students running the poo through some DNA analysis machine? Like, what happens in your lab once you get it home?
Yeah, so yeah, it's smelly. So normally how they deal with the poop is that they'll freeze dry it, and then of course to extract the DNA you have to make it liquid again so that we can dissolve everything.
It's going from bad to worse.
Yeah, so it's normally you give the other people in the lab a warning if it's going to be a poop day, and so people know to stay away and yeah.
You're listening to Science Files, and we're talking about whale poop with Professor Tim Fraser. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to the Science Files, and we're talking marine mammals today. If you have a call, you are welcome to call in and talk to Dr. Tim Fraser, 902-405-6000. And if you're outside Halifax, we'll pay for your call, 1-877-801-8255. Now, I believe, Adam, you had a question that you wanted to put to Tim.
Yeah, I was just thinking, as you were saying during your PhD, that you identified there was missing whales, you know, that they... You thought that the species was well counted, and then your work showed that there was some that you had missed, and maybe also with your poop analysis that maybe you're missing some. So in general, you know, how reliable are counting techniques for these species at risk in the water?
Yeah, so it's a good question. And there's not a clear answer. The techniques themselves are good. I think and it's the same. I should make it clear that kind of it's the same techniques if you're estimating abundance of whales or elk or anything. Like, it's the same. The math is the same. The statistics are the same. And the methods are the same. But the big issue is where are you sampling? So where are you surveying for individuals? Because that's obviously going to influence who you see. So whenever you're estimating abundance, you want to try to make sure that you're covering the whole area that the individuals might occur in to make sure that you're not missing anyone. And of course, that's very difficult with whales, especially, you know, we don't know where they are a huge chunk of the year, and the North Atlantic's a pretty big place. So it's hard to make sure you have that good coverage, and so kind of people just do the best with what they can, and hopefully that's enough. I mean, you try to justify that, you try to survey in the right areas to make sure that your estimate is going to be accurate, but of course, other means of research can infer things, and that can let you know if there's some gaps in your survey design or something like
right,
that.
It must be hard because there's some areas where the species might all go because that's where the food is, and they've left all their other traditional places because food's been depleted. And so if you're only looking in the one place where they all are, you might think there's many.
Yeah, and it's actually been an issue lately with the North Atlantic right whale where I'd say this past summer was good, but for maybe 2 to 3 summers before that, they hardly used the Bay of Fundy. So that used to be their major feeding ground, was the Bay of Fundy. And we had about 3 years where there was maybe 1 or 2 whales seen there. So they certainly show huge variation in their habitat use patterns, depending on presumably what food's available there and what the conditions are like. So it depends on where you when you do your surveys and what the whales are doing.
I want to jump in, though. So we every now and again, you'll see a story about some shark that's gone miles and they have a radio tracker on it. Is it possible to put radio trackers on whales?
Yeah, it's a good question that people ask all the time, because that's one thing with any species of whales is we don't know where they are a lot of the time. And with North Atlantic right whales, they're very good at breaking tags. So they seem to be very sensitive. So they also another issue with right whales is they get entangled in fishing gear all the time, and lots of whales do. So humpback whales, fin whales, minke whales, they all get entangled in fishing gear. And there's teams of people that their job is to go out and disentangle these whales. And all the disentanglement teams say that, you know, right whales will try to kill you when you disentangle them, whereas a humpback will go kind of docile while they disentangle them. But right whales, they don't like things on their skin. They don't like people being close to them, more so than any other species that they've worked with. So although satellite tagging works for some whale species, it doesn't seem to work well with North Atlantic right whales, because as soon as you get a satellite tag in, they'll dive to the bottom and rub against the bottom and try to break that off. So far, satellite tagging hasn't worked real well for that species.
That's really amazing. Because it would be great if we could actually track them, but if they're actively taking their tracking markings off, that's just like really frustrating.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to go slightly broader now. So you are very interested in conservation of animal populations in general. I'm going to ask you that $64,000 question that's really, really big and a little bit unfair, but I'm going to do it anyway. How do you think humans are doing in terms of addressing conservation issues in a number of animal populations? Because, I mean, statistically, we're coming up to what people call the sixth extinction.
Yeah. No, I think we're doing pretty bad, especially from the whale standpoint. I don't think I've...
No, even though, like you were saying, the right whales are starting to recover, they've gone from 300 to 500?
Yeah, I don't think that's because of anything that we've done.
I think that's
just what they're doing. I think with all whales, the major cause of mortality for pretty much every whale species is entanglement. And entanglement in fishing gear, and we've known that forever. And there's, you know, if you look at what Canada's done to reduce the amount of mortalities from fishing gear, it's almost nothing. And this,
so what can we do? That would be my next question.
Yeah. So this is
It's a tough political question,
right?
So
one issue in Canada and the U.S. is you have the same government agency responsible for whale conservation that's also responsible for managing the fisheries.
Oh, okay.
And so, you know, obviously the clear result, which obviously isn't looked on favorably, is to reduce the amount of fishing gear in the water.
Sure.
And that's obviously going to reduce the amount of whales entangled. And of course, that doesn't sit well with a lot of people, particularly in the Maritimes. And so a lot of money and a lot of work has gone into modifying fishing gear. So come up with rope that has a weaker breaking strength and things like that. And so far, not much of those modifications have been successful. There's been some recent research showing that actually since entanglements have gotten worse, since fishermen have moved to polypropylene line when fishermen were using more natural fibers, the whales could actually break free from that. So now, I don't know if fishermen are going to do it, but research suggests that if we make just ropes a little bit weaker out of more natural fibers, the whales could actually break free from that a lot easier, and then entanglement would be less of an issue. So I think there's a sweet spot where the line can be strong enough to fish successfully, but be weak enough that the whales can break free the majority of the time that they're entangled. So there's not a silver bullet that's going to solve this problem, but I don't think the Canadian and the U.S. governments are really taking it seriously enough now.
Okay, so my next question then is inevitably, what is your long-term prognosis for the whale populations?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, that's a good question.
So you serve on a committee that looks at species at risk and tries to evaluate whether populations are going up and down, or you know, with that kind of work, do you see any populations that are recovering, and your committee recommends releasing them from the endangered list.
Yeah, so certainly, yeah. So I'm not sure if people know, there's Canada has this group called COSIWIC, or the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada. And so there's different subcommittees that, you know, they're groups of experts that meet once a year and talk about the status of different species and try to evaluate which species we still need to be considered endangered and which ones are recovering.
And I presume this is across the whole animal kingdom, or everything that we have in Canada and so on.
Yeah. So there's an invertebrate group, there's a fungus group, and then I'm on the marine mammal committee. And so, yeah, so certainly a lot of whale populations are increasing. And so I think they can do really well. Like they've been through many climatic changes, right? Like I think they can adapt to changes and can, you know, change where they go to. And that's one good thing about being so large and having such good fat reserves, is you can kind of make it through some changes depending on how long those last.
Well, I've got to jump in because, I mean, to be frank, this is the first time I've really heard much about climate change impacting whales. So how does climate change impact whales?
Oh, yeah. No, we're seeing lots of effects right now. And, of course, you know, I think as conservation biologists, it's tempting to, you know, to say climate change is always going to be bad. But, of course, it's also going to expand the range of some species. So we actually think it's going to be quite bad for the Arctic adapted species. So beluga whales, narwhals, bowhead whales. We see their ranges contracting already in the Arctic. But then species that live in more temperate waters, their ranges are expanding. So things like orcas are able to expand their range a lot more. And we're seeing shifts already. So a lot of dolphin species that used to be kind of more tropical or kind of in the lower temperate latitudes, they're shifting their distributions north. So we can actually kind of track the effects of climate change by looking at how dolphins are shifting their distributions north. So that's kind of distribution, but one thing we don't understand is how climate change is going to affect the food availability, which is going to be much more complex.
So what's going to happen to the zooplankton and so on.
Yeah. So how changing oceanographic condition, or how changing ocean temperatures are going to combine with changing ocean currents, and how that's going to influence where the zooplankton's concentrated in the ocean, and if the whales are going to be able to find those patches that are going to be in different places than they were before. And so there's just no real way to predict that right now.
Wow. Well, I think that is a perfect way to finish. Tim, thank you so much for coming on and teaching us about marine mammals. I've certainly had a whale of a time there. I got it three times in one show. Adam, thank you so much for coming and sitting in the co-host chair. I really appreciate it. Folks, we have a very special show next week. Richard Zarowski will be back. Nobel Prize winner Art MacDonald as well. And I have to thank Leah Batstone, producer behind the glass. Join us next week for some great science talk.